They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. It's going to be jobs, jobs, and more jobs, roughly 431,000 of them, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, April 1st. Good to have you with us. Okay, so you heard the headline number, 431,000 jobs created last month. The unemployment rate is now just 3.6%, just a hair higher than the 50-year low that preceded the pandemic. That's, of course, the news from the Bureau of Labor Statistics today, and we're going to get right to it with Jordan Holman at Bloomberg and Neela Richardson at ADP. Hey, you two.
Hi, Amy.
Hey, Amy.
Neela, we'll start with you because you're our resident economist today. Another month of solid job growth. This is really good news for the American worker, yes?
It's really hard to find something not to like about this report. I mean, it was just really strong in a lot of ways. There was 431,000, as you mentioned, but it was broad-based. Both goods and services saw gains. That's also a good sign. We saw people coming back into the labor market. That's a great sign because we know labor shortages have been persistent over the course of the jobs recovery. A low unemployment rate at 3.6%, immaterially different than the 50-year low before the pandemic. So across the board, great news. Where to look for, if you want to look for problems, it's that labor force participation rate. It's still a percentage point lower than it was in 2020. And we're always going to be looking at wages because that's going to be the indicator of where inflation might go to by the end of the year.
Right. And Jordan, you know, not to look for problems, of course, but we did see wage growth last month, 13 cents an hour overall, and wages are up more than 5.5% year over year. But that is still lower than the rate inflation. What's your take on how consumers are doing right now?
Right. So even though people are getting more in their paychecks, they're also spending a lot more, especially at the grocery store. When you look at items like if you're trying to buy meat or seafood or even that beauty or health category. So that's a really tough thing because those are key items. You know, you can't not buy food and also just like the wellness trend. So that is something that retailers are thinking about specifically with where they can raise prices and on what categories will people be okay with paying a little bit more. But those items that I just mentioned, those are pretty core. So everyone's kind of in the retail world is kind of dancing around and trying to figure out exactly how much price increases that you can make until the consumer just stops buying.
Right. Neela, I wanted to dig into the different demographics a little bit in this report. I saw an interesting story in the AP yesterday talking about how a couple of years ago the Fed, you know, made it a goal to promote more inclusive job growth. And we have seen the Black unemployment rate come down a lot to 6.2% from a high of almost 17% early in the pandemic, but it's still almost twice as high as the rate for white workers. And I'm wondering, with the Fed now raising interest rates, do you see that gap narrowing anymore?
it really depends on how tight the labor market remains. That relationship that you're pointing out, the Black unemployment rate twice the rate of the white unemployment rate, is historical. It goes back way beyond the pandemic times. It's pre-pandemic reality. When the labor market is really good, really strong, really tight, really hot, that gap narrows. But in a typical normal or even a bad jobs market, the gap widens historically to twice the rate for Blacks. So there has been some thought in policy circles is about not targeting the overall unemployment rate because it excludes certain groups, people of color, sometimes different pockets of low-wage workers and women. And the Fed has acknowledged this in its own text and policy statements, saying that growth should be broad-based and inclusive. So I expect more of that language to come out now that we've hit kind of a marker in terms of the overall market looking like it's basically recovered.
Jordan, I understand you were at a big retail conference in Las Vegas recently, and I'm curious what you're hearing from retailers about their outlook and also how they're making decisions about pricing and inventories as we enter kind of the spring, perhaps a more optimistic spring, COVID-wise.
Definitely. I mean, it was optimistic because this conference had like 10,000 people, something you would not have seen wow. just a few months ago.
Yeah.
But one of the hottest topics was inflation and specifically pricing and how much you're going to increase prices or can you increase prices. Like, for example, I spoke to an executive at Levi's. They've done several price tests to see how willing people were to pay for full price for their denim jeans. And they found that people are keeping it at a premium price. Then you have a company like Signet, which owns most of the mall jewelry stores that you know, like Jared and Zales, and they're going to try to raise prices but keep it at a minimum. And that company is really interesting because they're mass market, and this goes back to the idea that like not every consumer is the same. That higher income Americans, they're very willing to pay more for their luxury goods, but in general, the middle market, they have to hold the line on how much they can increase. And so pricing tools, inflation was definitely a topic that everyone was talking about at the conference and that retailers are definitely thinking about right now.
Well, if we can get a little personal for a moment, I'm curious because you both are consumers, obviously, as well as experts. And you were, Jordan, just speaking about kind of inflation expectations. People may be willing to pay a little more if they know prices are going up. Neela, has it changed the way you're buying, the way you're feeling about the future?
Well, when you're cheap to begin with, Amy.
yeah, I'm with you there.
Doesn't change much. No, it does. It does change my outlook. I'm much more willing to comparison shop. I'm personally much more willing to wait on it to come back down again. But a lot of folks and a lot of spending isn't so discretionary. It's not so optional. You have to pay the rent. And you've seen inflation and rents really skyrocket. I think the problem with the inflation now is it's headed into those essentials that people have to buy and they don't have so much discretion. But between you and me, if I can wait for it, for the price to come down or come on sale, I will.
So interesting, you're not stocking up before prices get even higher. What about you, Jordan? real quick, how are you changing your shopping?
Yeah, so I live here in Atlanta, definitely a car city, but I am trying to walk places where I can just so I don't have to go to the tank as often. It is a Herculean effort because everyone drives here in Atlanta, but with prices at the pump, I'm really trying to just alter like my transportation habits.
Same. My kid forgot her coat the other day at school, and I just refused to drive down there and bring it to her because, you know, it costs. All right. Neela Richardson is at ADP. Jordan Holman comes to us from Bloomberg. Thanks so much and have a great weekend.
You too. Thanks.
You too.
Wall Street had a little more bounce in its step on the way to the weekend. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Sticking with the jobs theme, I mentioned the unemployment rate is now 3.6%, pretty darn close to the 3.5% of February 2020. Meanwhile, the number of people working or actively looking for work has been rising steadily, many of them drawn back into the labor force by higher wages. After months of strong job growth and interest rates going up, you kind of got to wonder, though, how long can it last? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has that one.
22 million jobs evaporated from the U.S. economy after the pandemic hit 2 years ago. It's been a deep hole to dig out of, but today's report shows we've recovered more than 90% of those lost jobs.
Right now, we're about 1.6 million jobs below where we were in February 2020.
Elise Gould at the Economic Policy Institute points out the U.S. working age population did grow over those 2 years.
If we take into account people graduating high school, entering in the labor market, we're down about 3.4 million jobs. That shortfall, I think, can easily be made up by the end of the year at the kind of growth we're seeing right now.
And that, folks, is just incredibly fast, at least compared to other recent job-destroying events like the Great Recession. To keep up this unusually steady and strong job growth, we'll need more people to return to work. Fortunately, key groups that left the labor force are coming back, says Kurt Long at the National Association of Federally Insured Credit Unions.
The Omicron wave knocked a bunch of young moms out of the labor force, but they have since returned with the moderation in COVID cases.
Long says schools and daycares reopening has helped. Meanwhile, older people who stopped working for fear of getting COVID,
a lot of those folks have come back out of retirement and are re-entering the labor force.
And the continuing surge in consumer spending, especially for in-person services, is driving demand for labor to come off the sidelines, says Kate Bond at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth.
Particularly the low end of the spectrum for our workers, bringing them in and giving them a little bit of wage growth.
None of which is to say some big wrench couldn't jam the works of this strong job market, says William Rogers at the St. Louis Fed. He lists three risks at the top of his list.
What happens to the path of inflation? We need more variants from COVID. And then the longer that the conflict that we're seeing in Ukraine continues.
So far, though, none of these potential risks have seemed to slow the pandemic jobs recovery even a little. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
That's enough macroeconomics for now. Let's move on to the micro, shall we? Jordan Holman was talking about how retailers are feeling in this inflationary environment. With Easter upon us and consumers planning to spend on average about $170 on the holiday, according to the National Retail Federation, we thought we'd check in with one of our retail regulars. Irene Kesselman, owner of Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina, sent us this dispatch.
Right now in our store, business has been really strong. We have everything from plush Easter bunnies to Easter chocolate, Easter slime, as well as other things that are non-Easter that will go into a basket as well, like bath bombs and pencils and that kind of thing. Ordering is crazy. You really don't know necessarily what you're going to be getting when you write an order. Some of the manufacturers are doing their best to provide us with what they have available, but it really gets tough when you buy from hundreds of vendors to keep track of what they do have and what they don't have on hand. We are still seeing price increases across the board, both with materials as well as shipping costs. We are forced to raise our prices in some cases, and in some cases, I am biting the bullet and taking a lower markup. My inventory is really high right now. In fact, it's probably equivalent to a holiday fourth quarter time of the year. I did that primarily because of the threat with price increases by a certain time. So I tried to order as much as I could up front, which means our stock room is extremely full right now. I think it'll be telling after Easter what happens. You know, I'm always a step ahead, as you have to be in retail. So right now I'm converting a lot of our outdoor to pool and beach, and we have buckets and pails and sprinklers. And that's the name of the game, overlapping constantly.
Summer, it's coming. That was Irene Kesselman of Alley Cat Toys in Carrboro, North Carolina. Coming up.
There were flames behind the house and said, okay, I should pack.
Yeah, you should. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 139 points, 0.4%, to close at 34,818. The NASDAQ eked out 40 points, about 0.3%, to finish at 14,261. And the S&P 500 found 15 points, 0.3%, to end at 4545. For the week, the Dow lost 0.1%, the NASDAQ gained 0.7%, the S&P 500 tacked on 0.1%. An S&P Global survey of managers at Russian manufacturing companies shows that factories cut production and jobs last month after the U.S. and other countries imposed those economic sanctions. The research also showed rising prices and a big decline in factory orders. Bonds in the U.S. fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. I told you it was going to be jobs, jobs, jobs. One type of job that saw big gains last month was in professional and business services. Think accountants, IT workers, consultants, the kinds of things people did in office buildings before the pandemic. The sector added more than 100,000 positions just last month, and it's actually up about 700,000 since before the pandemic. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
It's been a pretty busy year for Sherelle T. Martin. She runs an accounting firm called Nitram Financial that works with a lot of interior design companies. She says her clients have had a lot of work during the pandemic.
Everybody has revamped, remodeled, rechanged their entire house. Now that they're there more, it's like, hey, let's make this more appealing.
Martin's company had just 2 employees last year. And 2 weeks ago, to help manage her growing workload, Martin hired a new employee, and she's still looking.
I have a very aggressive growth strategy, which will require me to have at least 2 more people. So the plan is to hire.
Employment in the professional and business services sector has stayed strong throughout the pandemic, in part because many of those jobs can be done from home. That's also given companies in the sector a bigger talent pool to hire from, says Paul McDonald with the staffing firm Robert Half.
Why don't we recruit somebody that can live in Kansas City, even though we're based in San Francisco, if they have the right skill set?
McDonald says virtual work also created its own demand for these kinds of jobs, especially IT positions.
Because if you think about organizations that had to pivot to work from home, they didn't have the tech support. They didn't have the cloud computing. They needed help.
And as the economy has started to come back and other industries have been hiring, demand for consultants and accountants has gone up too, says Katie Berkelow with the staffing company Randstad USA.
You can't increase jobs, let's say in a restaurant, and not have somebody handling the payroll for those professionals.
Berkelow says it's been difficult to fill these roles lately, especially with such a low unemployment rate. As a result, economist Kathy Bosjancic at Oxford Economics says pay in the sector has been rising.
Year on year, average hourly earnings for professional business services workers is up 6.7%.
Bosjancic says that's a sign that this job sector is leading the economic recovery. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
The theme of a forecast from the National Interagency Fire Center out today is above normal, as in many parts of the country can expect above normal potential for significant wildfires in the coming months. The number of acres burned year to date is about 20% higher than the 10-year average. Every time a major wildfire burns through a town, it can seem kind of random which homes burn down and which ones survive. Turns out one factor that accounts for some of that difference is building codes, and getting owners to bring older homes up to code isn't easy. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
In the mid-1980s, Jim and Ann Pisote fell in love with 10 acres of land in the forest in Northern California. They bought it and started building a house.
We built the furniture and the cabinets and pounded almost all the nails.
Almost 30 years later, in September 2015, Anne was at work, Jim was at home.
And someone called Jim and said, you know, get out. And he looked up and saw there were flames behind the house and said, okay, I should pack.
They'd evacuated before, and their house had always been fine, so they weren't really worried. But this fire, the Butte Fire, was huge and fast-moving, and it destroyed more than 500 homes, including theirs.
We had redwood deck around the outside of the house. And we had cedar siding, which we had just oiled. So
our house was a big tiki torch, is really what it was. And the fire came up, lit it up.
Eventually, the Pisotes had a new house built. It's a lot different than their old one.
There's no wood on the outside of our new house. It's surrounded by a concrete patio.
The chimney is rock. The roof is metal. We have a slab foundation, and there's no vents up into any attic space that we have.
A lot of those design choices weren't really choices. All new houses in fire-prone areas of California now have to meet strict building codes, designed to make them less likely to burn. Since 2008, the state's had rules about keeping a certain amount of space around homes clear of trees and brush, rules about what materials people can use for their roofs.
Rules for siding, rules for vents, rules for decks and fences.
Judson Boomhauer is a professor at the University of California, San Diego. A recent study he worked on, published by the National Bureau of Economic Research, found those requirements have made a big difference.
And there's also pretty clear benefits to your neighbors if you live in a dense area.
The study found newer homes in California that are built to code are 40% more likely than older homes to survive a major wildfire. But only about a million homes in the state have been built since those codes went into effect, says Dan Dunmoyer at the California Building Industry Association.
That means that there's approximately 13.5 to 14 million California homes that have not been built to these safety codes.
Older homes are grandfathered in. California does not require people who own them to do any kind of retrofitting. And not many are doing it voluntarily.
Retrofitting homes is going to be more expensive than building a home from start.
Kimiko Barrett at the nonprofit research group Headwaters Economics says the only way California is going to get a significant number of people to bring older homes up to code will be to mandate it.
But having said that, you can't do that without providing homeowner subsidies for those homeowners to actually pay for those costs, because we do know that not everyone can afford what it's going to take to meet these mitigation measures.
In the absence of mandates and subsidies, Amy Bach at the nonprofit United Policyholders says there is another way to get people to make upgrades voluntarily: their insurance premium.
Give them a discount for replacing their roof, or give them a discount for maintaining defensible space, or for replacing their windows.
Until recently, insurance companies didn't do that. But some are starting to, and Bach says that's a big incentive for homeowners, especially in high fire risk areas where premiums have skyrocketed.
In a perfect world, people would do everything they could to make it less likely that their house was going to be destroyed. But in this world, where people are typically on limited budgets, generally there has to be some trigger that gets people to spend money on something that normally would not be a priority.
Jim and Ann Pisote just moved into their new home about 6 months ago, more than 5 years after their old one burned. Meeting the building code requirements cost them a lot of money, but
I'm actually glad that California has all of these regulations that require that we build it in a certain way so that we will be safe in there. They did us a big favor.
They sleep better at night now, Pisote says, knowing their new house is a lot less likely to burn. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Amazon workers in New York City have voted to form the company's first labor union at a U.S. facility. The vote at the JFK 8 Fulfillment Center on Staten Island was about 55% in favor and follows a grassroots organizing effort by current and former workers. Unlike many union drives backed by a large national organization, this group opted to start their own Amazon Labor Union. A similar effort at a warehouse in Alabama is too close to call, with more no votes right now and hundreds of contested ballots. This is the second vote at that facility. In a statement, Amazon said it's disappointed with the outcome in New York and is evaluating its options to challenge the vote. According to a filing with the Labor Department, Amazon spent more than $4 million on consultants last year to fight union efforts. And here's your moment of economic context. One last tidbit from that jobs report. The percentage of people working remotely because of the pandemic fell from 13% in February to just 10% last month, from a peak of around 33%. A sign that back-to-the-office plans are gaining steam. March 28th, in fact, Monday, was the official voluntary reopening day here at Marketplace. Emphasis on voluntary, she says from her living room closet. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fragali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.